If a small flock of cartoon bluebirds didn't help you get dressed this morning, that just means you haven't yet listened to Fine Tuning with Jim Hill and Drew Taylor. No, the black dress slacks, please. Thank you. And now, Jim Hill.
Welcome to Fine Tuning with Drew Taylor, your one-stop shop when it comes to animation news and commentary. I'm Drew's co-host, entertainment writer Jim Hill, and I'm Skyping into today's show from the woods of New Hampshire, where no lie, Drew, just before we sat down to record this podcast, I had to actually break out a saw and a pair of shears because a beaver got into the brook next to our house and took down a tree, which then blocked the driveway. So let me say, we've all thought from Lady and the Tramp that they're very helpful, you know, the beavers, and it's just not the case. They are vicious creatures with sharp teeth.
That does not make me miss the Northeast at all, I gotta say.
Speaking of which, you actually went north this week, though, out of L.A. up to Emeryville. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. I was up there for the Incredibles 2 in-home day. They don't call it home video anymore because it's digital and whatever else. But yeah, I was up there for the Incredibles 2. Again, I feel like every few months, when I walked into my interview with John Walker and Brad Bird, it's like, oh, I see you guys every 3 months about, you know, it's like, you get your teeth cleaned and you go talk to the guys that made Incredibles 2. So.
Wow. We'll get a little more in-depth than that into the second half of the show, but I have to ask, when you were on the Pixar campus up in Emeryville, did you see the Heimlich choo-choo train?
No, the whole train?
Well, that is the story that's coming out of, I mean, obviously, A Bug's Land closed at Disney California Adventure the first week of September, right?
Yep.
You know, supposedly out of everything that was there, and in fact, it kind of surprises me because they made such a big deal about, you know, come find the giant four-leaf clover, but evidently the one thing that's going back up to Emeryville after it's refurbished is the Heimlich choo-choo train, and I'm just wondering, A, when it gets there, and B, where the hell are they going to put it?
Yeah, are they going to, like, put the track down, or is it just the ride vehicles, or what?
I have no idea. Maybe they'll put it outside by the ball and the lamp, or the next time you get up there, you know, keep an eye out for it.
I will.
Now, though, speaking of traveling, I should have gone to New York Comic Con, because there's some very cool news coming out of it, but I hate going to the Javits Center.
Oh, it's terrible.
It's the worst place on the planet to have a convention. And I say that having been to, where is CinemaCon held?
Oh, in Las Vegas. Yeah. I don't know where. Isn't it in the Caesars?
It's just, you know, and nothing says, let's go enjoy a movie like walking through a casino full of smoke. But I will say, though, that I wish I was there just to be there with a crowd and to see on the big screen the new trailer for Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
Yeah, that trailer was very cool. The one reason people should go see Venom this weekend, and I think the cat's already out of the bag, but the after the credit sequence is not actually tied to Venom or Spider-Man or anything. It's actually a 4-minute sequence from Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
Oh.
Yeah.
I had almost talked myself out of going to Venom because the reviews have been, I think Rotten Tomatoes has it at like 26 at this point.
Yeah, it's a terrible movie, but you get a scene from...
Damn it, Drew. Yeah. Now I gotta go. Okay.
Now you gotta go. Yeah.
But yeah, that's an absolutely killer trailer. And more to the point, I love how weirdly specific it is. I mean, you know, for example, I think it's Screen Rant that just did the piece about how when you look at the Spider-Man in that movie, I mean, they don't get around. They get right to the point, like, this is the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man. You see recreations of the scene from Spider-Man 2 where he stops the train. And
yeah, the upside-down kiss.
Yeah, that's it exactly. Yep. It just allows you to start the story immediately. It's like, okay, you know this character, you know this world. You know, we don't have to do the origin story for the 35th time.
Right.
Because obviously this is the story of Miles Morales, not Peter Parker. Speaking of which, what did you think of these scenes that showed five different iterations of Spider-Man all in one place.
Oh, I thought it was so cool. I love the Spider-Men that they chose, too. I love that they chose Spider-Man Noir, Spider, who's like a kind of Japanese, young Japanese girl, Spider-Gwen, Spider-Ham, voiced by John Mulaney.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm really excited about Spider-Man Noir, by, voiced by Nick Cage, too. I think that's pretty fun, especially since he got to finally voice Superman in the Teen Titans movie earlier this year. So yeah, he's just killing it.
Did you ever see that documentary that about Superman Lives?
Oh, yeah. John Schnepp, who sadly passed away earlier this year.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a good little documentary.
No, absolutely. I mean, you really get, there's some wonderful behind-the-scenes footage of, Cage doing the costume test, and you just get a sense of, this might have been a really interesting take on the material. But again, of course, you know, the studio chickened out and we got what we got.
Yeah. I mean, just think about how many toys they're going to sell of how many different Spider-Man characters there are in that movie.
Speaking of toys, because in fact, my daughter in the car today was just showing me the images of the She-Ra and Katra toys. One of the big things that's being pushed out ahead of its November 16th debut at Netflix is She-Ra and the Princess of Power, the new DreamWorks animation thing. And based on the trailer, which also just dropped today, looks like a lot of fun. But again, one of the things, again, I hate the Javits, but I still would love to have checked out this food truck that they were doing in front of, it's the Fandom food truck.
Oh, what was it?
Well, this time around, they had the She-Ra Confection of Protection, which basically was a rainbow-colored smoothies with jelly beans and candy on top of it, but with a sword-shaped cookie sticking out of it. And again, getting back to Venom, you know, you could have had that and then washed it down with a Venom Black Lemonade or a Doctor Who Regeneration Tonic.
That's really funny because they were pushing that Black Lemonade at the junket. They had giant bottles of it. Nesty or somebody makes it, and they were like, do you want any more bottles of Venom Black Lemonade? And it was like, no, I'm okay. I think I'm just going to try it. I haven't tried it yet, so I will do that before the next show.
Okay.
I will give you my full review of the Venom Black Lemonade. Yeah.
Well, and when we say full review, I don't know if I want to know what the end product looks like. Moving on. Let's see. What also is being... We talked last show about Hilda. They're also doing a kind of a fun push at the New York Comic Con for Hilda. In fact, if you go by the Flying Eye booth, you can have your picture taken with a 6-foot-tall wolf. It's that weird dog-shaped thing that you see flying through the
cloud. Oh, I love that.
Yeah. And speaking of oversized props, if you feel the need to climb inside one of the racers from Star Wars Resistance. But yeah, you can go by booth 436. And
have you seen Star Wars Resistance yet or no?
I am supposed to get my hands on it later today, but I've been watching the clips and the trailers out there, and I like the anime style. I think it's kind of an interesting departure from what they did with Rebels, which was very, very inspired by Ralph McQuarrie's early concept work in the Star Wars films. But a change is a healthy thing, you know, to change up the look. But that said, they've just released a trailer for the new Harley Quinn animated series, and they've got Kaley Cuoco, you know, from The Big Bang Theory now voicing the character, and I'm sorry, Harley Quinn is always, to me, going to be Arlene Sokol.
Right.
The way Paul Dini originally wrote her and, you know, the way she was cast for Batman the Animated Series. Speaking of which, you were just making your way through that huge Blu-ray, weren't you? Or
no, I still have it pre-ordered. They haven't sent it to me yet, but I have it pre-ordered. But that's what's interesting is that little commercial reminded me of the Batman the Animated Series episode Harley and Ivy. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that one where they like a Thelma and Louise almost?
Mm-hmm.
Such a great episode. But yeah, I mean, the stuff that Paul Dini did, I don't understand why Paul Dini and Bruce Timm aren't given the reins of the actual DC universe, because I feel like they would just do such a better job with all of this stuff than people are doing these days.
It's so funny you say that. I've been thumping that tub for years. It seems like such a common sense thing, but
yeah.
But at the same time, when you have that sort of conversation with folks, it's, well, they're TV people. And worse than that, they're TV animation people. I mean, we're making a movie. You know, and it's just sort of like, okay. You know, you don't want to go with the guy who actually knows how to write for this character? It's like, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It's never made any sense to me, but...
Given that you brought up the pairing of Harley and Poison Ivy and what fun that was, and brings us to other women you shouldn't mess with, and that's the ladies who worked in Disney's ink and paint department. And I've been following for a while now the projects that are going to be coming out by way of Disney Play, the subscription streaming service. And just this past week, a deadline broke that they're going to do a documentary series that sort of uses... Mindy Johnson's, that great book she did last year, Ink and Paint, The Women of Walt Disney's Animation.
Yeah, that was great.
But they're using that as a jumping off point for a series of documentaries. That's just kind of thrilling to hear because the Ink and Paint department basically went away mid-90s, right?
Yeah, I think Rescuers Down Under was the first completely CAPS movie, correct?
Yeah, and then from there, all of that talent and all of that. In fact, it's so funny. I think we talked a little on an earlier show about the fact that when they were working on the animated scenes for Mary Poppins Return, I'm blanking the name of, but she was a veteran ink and paint person. They actually brought her in to consult on the CAPS work and the computer coloration of the characters because it's like, they wanted that 1960s animation feel to the stuff that was being done in 2018. She came in and consulted them on the line work and the coloration. And
well, I mean, looking at that animation, and which we exclusively revealed was a combination of Pixar and Walt Disney Animation Studios last time,
yep.
It looks so real and great and true to the animation style of original Mary Poppins. So,
and speaking of things that we sort of let the cat out of the bag about early on, I mean, you and I on an earlier show had talked about the Lilo and Stitch live-action reboot that was in the development pipeline, and Disney finally confirmed what we were talking about. I guess Dan Lin and Jonathan Erich of Rideback are producing it. They're the same guys who did the Aladdin with Will Smith that's coming out in May of next year for Disney.
Right.
And I guess Mike Van Wass is writing the screenplay. So it's still relatively early on. In fact, folks I've spoken with the studio, nobody yet wants to talk about whether or not this is going out theatrically, or this is Disney Play, but it's coming.
The reason I would suspect that it's going theatrical is that Stitch has a huge presence overseas, that Asian audiences love Stitch. And they also love Angel, who is Stitch's girlfriend from, I believe, the second movie, the direct-to-video sequel. Mm-hmm. And so I would wager that Stitch is going to be theatrical. But speaking of Stitch, did you see the reports that the Stitch attraction in the Magic Kingdom has already been dismantled and broken apart? Do you have any insight on that?
Yeah. I mean, Len and I were just talking about this because Rafiki's Planet Watch, in much the same way that Stitch's Great Escape went seasonal before it eventually went away, they're doing the same thing with Planet Watch. It's going to shut down later this month and reopen next spring. They're clearing it out and they're getting the space ready. And as I think we talked about on the last show, it's very dependent on how Ralph Breaks the Internet does in 4 or 5 weeks from now.
Yeah.
Alice and I just today were over at the Disney store at the Outlet Mall. The first wave of the Wreck-It Ralph 2 stuff has arrived. And it's just kind of weird. You can buy, like, for example, the vehicle from the Slaughter Race game.
Right.
Here's Vanellope with her sunglasses on looking super cool, and here's Ralph looking terrified. And it's like, well, okay, let's play with that.
You know what's funny about that merch is that I've heard that the rabbit that eats the pancakes from the trailer
yep.
did not actually make it into the final cut of the movie, but there are dozens of toys made of this character.
Oh my God, are you serious?
Yeah.
I heard Alice from across the store. It's like, oh my God, the cat with the milkshake and the rabbit with the pancakes. And, you know, I mean, right. here are the plush.
Yep, not in the movie. So,
wow.
At least, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, nuts. Okay.
Yeah.
Going from one alien dog movie Stitch to another dog movie. One that project that we know is going out through Disney Play is this Lady and the Tramp remake, which they've been shooting for a while. I guess Tessa Thompson is going to be voicing Lady and Justin Theroux is going to be Tramp.
Yeah, they've been shooting in London, I believe. Yeah.
Okay. But what I find kind of intriguing when you look at this is that, you know, they're constantly looking now to sort of balance the scales, you know, make sure that there are, for example, especially in our Me Too age, more female roles. So did you see where there's no jock in this movie? It's Jackie?
No, I had no idea.
Yeah.
Scottish Terrier?
Yes. You know, Ashley Jensen is going to be voicing that. The other one, I think just today, Arturo Castro has been added to the cast. He's going to be working at Tony's. So Bellinona makes it into this movie. So Charlie Bean of the Lego Ninjago movies directing.
Not my favorite Lego movie of the bunch.
Yeah, but it still had some fun stuff.
Yeah.
Does the world really need a Lady and the Tramp? I mean, it's dogs. They're cute. People like to go to movies with dogs. Didn't I just hear that they're doing a sequel to A Dog's Life, the thing that Josh Gad did all the voice work for?
Yes, I believe it's coming out next year.
That was the movie where spoiler alert, folks, they killed the dog like 5 times over the course of the movie and he kept getting reincarnated.
Yeah, well, wasn't that also the movie that had the like allegations of animal abuse on set too?
Yeah, they had that footage of the dog being thrown in the water for the drowning sequence, and it's just,
yeah.
All I could think of is like, wow, that's Old Yeller again and again and again. Have you cried enough? Oh, wait a minute, we're going to kill the dog again. Anyway, I guess I have to wait to judge whether or not, you know, we need this remake, this sequel. But again, I remember I was the one who also complained about Incredibles 2 and how that was kind of an unnecessary sequel. And now what? It's the top grossing Pixar movie ever, is that correct?
Ever, Jim, ever.
All right, so what the hell do I know? Well, I'll tell you what I don't know. I don't know what Drew learned when he was up at the Emeryville campus, you know, talking with the filmmakers and the creatives, you know, just earlier this week. So tell you what, we're going to jump off here, folks, do a quick break, and when we get back, Drew will share what he learned from all the folks who worked on Incredibles 2.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breidinger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for craveable, hand-battered, cooked-to-order chicken fingers.
Chicken up.
Crispy, crinkle-cut fries.
Hot potato coming through.
Buttery Texas toast.
Toast walking.
And secret Cane's sauce.
Topping off now.
Turbocharge your chicken fingers and get them even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app.
Go, go, go!
Raising Cane's chicken fingers. One love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
And we're back. Now, again, you had done the earlier for the film release one, right?
Yeah, I'd done the long lead, and then I did the junket, and now I was back for the in-home release. I guess, like, the biggest thing was that we got to see Auntie Edna, which is the brand new short that will be available on every version of this movie, and acts as kind of a follow-up to the Jack-Jack Attack short from the first home video release, where you get to see Edna and Jack-Jack and the night that they spend together. And it's a really cute short. It's really funny and heartfelt. And you get to see Jack-Jack turn into some other things that you haven't seen him do yet. Like, he turned into a big firework at one point and is made of water at another point. And what was really interesting was I got to talk to the filmmakers, and they said that one of the challenges is they couldn't build any new sets. So they had to be in Edna's laboratory because they had redone it for the new movie.
Mm-hmm.
Initially, you know, it took place all over the house, and now it's just there. They started production earlier this year, and it's already finished, which is pretty amazing.
Holy cow.
Yeah, I guess it was an idea they always wanted to do, and they finally got the go-ahead for the short. So that was a lot of fun seeing that. And I mean, I don't have a Blu-ray copy yet, but I'm very excited to watch it again when I do.
And this having been, in some cases, your third conversation with the same set of filmmakers,
yeah.
What's that like? I mean, especially for those of you who don't know, when you don't go to the long lead, you're typically shown, what, 25, 30 minutes of scenes. And it's not, you know, sometimes if you're lucky, they'll show you, you know, a continuous part of the movie. But,
right.
But mostly it's like, okay, here are the 25 minutes of scenes that we want to show you.
Yeah.
Then comes the actual junket. And usually in that situation, you get to see the whole film and then talk with all of these folks who, at the long lead, they had to be reticent because, you know, they can't reveal the plot twist. And now, third time up at bat here.
Well, I like this period the most because they are less cagey about what they can or cannot talk about. They can mm-hmm. talk about the experience of releasing the movie, which is mm-hmm. obviously very interesting in this case now that it is the most profitable animated film of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like they're just a little bit more honest and open, and nothing they say can really come back at them about, you know, and impact the financials of the movie. And mm-hmm. so it was interesting. You know, I asked about, there was a lot of pre-production artwork and a lot of stuff made about how Edna was going to have a fashion show and that there were going to be supermodels that were dressed like superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I asked about that, and it was, you know, you've talked to Brad before. You know, he's the most honest, kind of open person in the world, and he talked about how too much was made about that, and it was just a little idea that was never funny enough to make it into the movie. But he also said, you know, that they made this movie so quickly and they came in under budget. And so he said, you know, I don't really look at reviews, but I read one about, you know, how the plot didn't quite line up, you know, totally intricately. And he's, you know, yelling, not at me, but, you know, he gets very animated. You've talked to Brad.
He does.
Yeah.
Yes.
And
yes,
he's like, do you know what it took to get this movie done? Like, you know, the plot not being perfect is the least of our worries. And so I think that he just felt relieved that it's done and mm-hmm. it got out. And I asked him, you know, do you feel any like momentum to just do a third one real quick and get it out of the way? And he said, absolutely not.
Mm.
He also told me, and this will be I issue a challenge to our listeners out there. He told me that his next project will be a project that had an older project of his that mixed computer animation and live action. That was at a different studio, but is now currently coming back to Disney and Pixar. Would not tell me what it is. It's not Ray Gun.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to know what this was. I'm sure it was announced or referenced or something at some point. So I want to figure out what it is. So Jim and everybody else, figure this out.
Hmm. You've seen his test for Spirit, right?
Ugh, so good. He did that himself, didn't he?
Yeah.
But I don't think he would do that.
Particularly now, you know, with Disney acquiring Fox and the X-Men and all that, it's like, oh yeah, let's make a superhero movie. That'll be different.
Right.
You know, no. You know.
No.
Okay. Yeah, all right. So, well, let's legitimately put that out there. If somebody has any insights, we'd love to hear about it.
Yeah.
Not only Brad, though, you got to speak with other folks who worked on the film, you know, for...
Yeah. I talked to a couple of the animators. I talked to the filmmakers behind Bao,
mm-hmm.
which is about to start its big Oscar push.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting is that I talked to a married couple
mm-hmm.
of animators who actually worked on the scene where Bob and Helen are fighting in the motel. And ooh. Each, the man in the couple took Bob's performance. The woman animator took Helen's performance, which is really interesting that they work together on a scene.
Mm-hmm.
They're married. They animated a married couple. It was pretty funny. And the performances are great, I guess, in part because they drew from real life for that.
Oddly enough, that was one of the more real moments in a pretty surreal film.
Yeah.
Was there anything you learned this time around that surprised you?
You know, I asked Brad about Tomorrowland, which... could have gone either way, quite yep. frankly. I know that you and I have spent a lot of time talking about Tomorrowland and what worked and what didn't work. And
yeah.
I'm an admirer of the film and mm-hmm. How weird and big it was for mm-hmm. a Disney movie. But he said, you know, I wouldn't have done anything differently. I am glad I did it instead of Star Wars. I still love Star Wars. You know, is it perfect? I don't know. But the experience was great and I'm so happy that I did it, which I thought was really honest. And he talked about how he's getting a lot of feedback now on Twitter from people who are just now watching Tomorrowland and loving it. And he said, you know, that's fine if a movie, you know, has to take a breath and people enjoy it later. But yeah, it was very interesting. I was very happy that he talked about that.
I have to admit, when I come across it now, and it has begun popping up on cable fairly regularly. And I find it does suck me in. There's so many great, weird little scenes. I found I'll look up and it's like, oh, 30, 40 minutes of a movie I just stopped on for a second. I always usually hang in there for the Eiffel Tower becoming a spaceship because... Of course. I mean, yeah. Of course it's a, you know, it's a gantry for a spaceship. I mean, I love it's hiding in plain sight.
So great.
Having done that, you're back in town. Do you and Katie have anything planned for the weekend, which of course is Columbus Day? You guys up to anything?
Well, we're going to Mickey's Halloween party tonight at, or tomorrow night at Disneyland, which I've never done before. So I'm very excited.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. You will enjoy, though. Interesting that you bring up Mickey, because I thought in honor of Columbus Day, we could talk about a project that Disney almost made, The Voyage of Christopher Columbus starring Mickey Mouse.
Oh, wow.
You've heard about this project, right?
I actually never had, but it's interesting because you will say when this is, you know, being developed. And there was really Christopher Columbus fever in the early 90s, right?
But largely coming off of the fact that 1992 was the 500th anniversary of Christopher Columbus. And let's be honest here, he didn't discover America. He discovered San Salvador. And even then, it was one of the other guys in the boat. Hey, look over there. And it's like, yeah. Okay, move the Pinta over there. Let's do this.
Right. But there were so many movies and stuff. Christopher Columbus, what was it, Voyage to a New World or whatever, and then 1492, Voyage for a New World, 1492, Conquest of Paradise, and then at the same time, Christopher Columbus, The Discovery.
Well, the one that always cracked me up was the Salkind, the one that the Salkinds
made? Yeah,
that
was the Discovery one, yeah. The Mario Puzo co-wrote the screenplay.
Yeah, well, the amazing thing is For a time, while they were making Superboy at Disney Studios, Disney MGM, they were talking about, you know, and well, you know, we have this Christopher Columbus movie, which we'd love to make here in Florida. And Disney, you know, kept sort of looking at it. And it's like, I don't know. So when Superboy moved over to Universal, the Salkinds did the same thing. It's like, hey, you know, we'd love to shoot it here in Florida. And the same thing, like, I don't know.
Right.
But speaking of the Florida connection, in order to understand why Disney would have wanted to cash in on the 500th anniversary of Discovery of America. But also, the idea was that Mickey's The Prince and the Pauper, that 25-minute long featurette, it's actually a great little featurette. It's a lot of fun, but it was also supposed to be the first of a series.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. In fact, I remember being at the Magic of Disney Animation, the walkthrough exhibit at Disney MGM, and one afternoon, you know how you could look into the fishbowl, the, you know, the work area?
Yeah, of course.
And in one of the workrooms, they had pinned up the storyboards for the scene for the second of the series, and that was Mickey's Arabian Adventure. And it was one of these things where it's like, oh, wait a minute, you're making Mickey's Arabian Adventure. Have you looked down the hall at the Aladdin project? Because we're kind of doing the same thing here. That's what ultimately killed Mickey's Arabian Adventure, was that, especially on the heels of the success of Beauty and the Beast, it's like, oh yeah, we want to do that now. We want another musical, and we don't necessarily want Mickey's Arabian Adventure crowding that out. So that one got pulled, but number three was supposed to be this story of Christopher Columbus. And the irony is, as they're working on this, I want to say Mike Gabriel is doing the sort of gong show things where they pitch it. You know, look for ideas for upcoming features. And Mike came in one day and pitched the idea of doing Pocahontas, only with the idea of doing... In fact, I think I shared this piece of concept art with you at one point.
Yes, I was working on... When I was at Disney, I did a story, I think, about this version of Pocahontas that he and Eric Goldberg had talked about. But you're talking about the image of basically Tiger Lily.
Yeah.
From Peter Pan that just says Walt Disney's Pocahontas on the top. And that was what got it the green light, right?
That's it, exactly. But I don't know if you've seen the Adam Ruins Everything series or the Adam Ruins History animated series, but they do a wonderful piece on Disney's Pocahontas and how much of that story that they got wrong and what a terrible person John was. But it turns out that Disney, at least in the original pitch, got Pocahontas's age right. She was only like an 8 or 9 year old girl when she met John Smith initially.
Not creepy at all, Jim. Not creepy at all.
Not creepy at all. But again, the original pitch was that they were going to age down John Smith so he was going to be a cabin boy on the ship that had come over and founded the Virginia Company. The idea was these two young kids were going to teach the adults how to behave, how to be, you know, peace between the indigenous people and, you know, the early English settlers. And however, once Beauty and the Beast came out in November of 91, it was this monstrous hit. You know, Katzenberg suddenly wanted a musical for adults. And so they aged up Pocahontas, and Glenn Keane made her the most striking creature on the planet.
He made it really boring. They all made it boring.
Again, at some point, you're going to have to share some of those stories from Eric and Mike. But anyway, come on full circle here. Just about the same time that Mickey's Christopher Columbus is moving forward, you know, Disney is beginning the initial work on off of the Gong Show presentation of Pocahontas. And so they start doing their research, and they drill down into the story of the indigenous people. And then they start to get to the part about how so many members of Columbus's crew behaved badly, and how many people who lived in the Caribbean at that time were killed. And it's just sort of like, yeah, this really sounds like a Mickey Mouse short. You know, that featurette, after a good, I want to say, 5 or 6 months of work and boarding and all that, gets put aside because it's, again, you know, this isn't an appropriate vehicle for Mickey. But they set this aside, and then they're like, well, let's explore doing something different with Mickey. Maybe we'll go back to the shorts, and maybe we'll do something fun, which is how we end up with 1995's Runaway Brain.
Ugh, I love Runaway Brain.
And Chris Bailey did such amazing work with that. Yes, you can find a certain amount of merch out there that's tied to Runaway Brain, but the studio really nowadays pretends that that film was never made.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, when I was at Disney, that was on our sort of list of things that we could not talk about, we could not discuss, we could not reference Runaway Brain ever. I have a Runaway Brain Mickey pin that I don't even know when I got it, but I'm so glad I did, because God knows they do not make it anymore. And I think it's so funny, you know, we've talked a little bit about Mickey's 90th anniversary.
Yes.
But how completely Runaway Brain has been wiped from the history books. Did you see that, the Blu-ray that's coming out that does not have it on there? It's really interesting.
I was just standing in Target the other morning holding the 90th Mickey collection series of action figures. And again, you've got a Golden Mickey, you've got a Steamboat Mickey, you got a Sorcerer's Apprentice Mickey. And again, it's like, where's my Runaway Brain Mickey? And it's like, oh, pal, you know, if you didn't get it back in the day, you are never getting it.
Right. You want the Mickey that almost raped Minnie, basically. I think that's the main issue that's keeping that away. But
Wow. At some point, you're going to have to tell me what else was on that list. In fact, tell you what, folks.
In big, bold words, it said Jim Hill. Do not talk to Jim Hill. Yeah.
In fact, folks, if you come out for our event in November, the one that the very nice folks at Storybook Destinations are setting up, November 9th through the 12th, is that?
Yep.
Okay. Drew and I will be down in Orlando. We are going to be taking a group of folks around the parks and sharing all sorts of stories about Pixar Animation and how they came into the Disney parks and resorts. And maybe when we're not talking about that, Drew could share a few other things on, you know, with other stories.
The vault will be open. Yeah.
You know, so if people are interested in finding other stuff that you're doing around the web and that sort of thing, where else can they find you?
Well, you can find me on moviephone.com. I'm the features editor and social media manager over there, so I'm always posting stuff there. You can follow me on Instagram and Twitter at Drew Tailored, TIILORED, like the tailored suit. And if you really like listening to me, you can listen to my Mission Impossible podcast, Light the Fuse, which I host with Charles Hood. That's all about the Mission Impossible franchise.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah.
Do you do the Mission Impossible TV series as well, or?
Oh yeah, yeah, and I think we're doing the 80s show even. So.
Oh my God! Really?
Yeah, yeah.
We were just talking about how when Martin Landau left the show, and they brought in Leonard Nimoy. I mean, I guess they had literally just canceled Star Trek, and so but they enjoyed working with Leonard Nimoy, so he came in to basically play the Martin Landau role in what
season? Yeah.
3 through 5, something like that, or
yeah, we haven't gotten there yet, but yeah, if you haven't seen it, Martin Landau basically plays a kind of magician, sleight of hand guy, and he's kind of that element, and he has a really great relationship with Barbara Bain, who plays Cinnamon, and they have a really great flirtatious relationship in the show. So yeah, oh, I'm getting deep into it.
Oh Jim. No, okay, I definitely gotta go check that out.
Yeah,
cool. All right, now I know what I'm listening to when I'm driving down to Florida for our event.
And Nova's calling me.
Yeah, Nova the Wonder Dog is telling us it's time to end the show, folks. So, all right. Well, on behalf of Drew and Nova, thanks for listening tonight, and we'll be back with another fine tuning very soon. Okay, take care.
Be sure to tune in again for another fine episode of Fine Tuning with Jim Hill and Drew Taylor.